Good afternoon. Let me get started over. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen, and we're here with Lee Child and Lori R. King to discuss this terrific new MWA handbook called How to Write a Mystery. And let's see, let me hold that up a little bit longer there. And Barbara is at her home office, and I'm here upstairs in the Poison Pen Press office. And through the magic of technology, Lori and Lee are joining us from different places, different cities. We're just talking about the technology, how it's changed everything for us this last year, and what a blessing it's been in a lot of ways. So for those of you watching, I'm going to be kind of monitoring the Facebook feed. And also, if you are watching, I see these, we have these scammers that try to get into our Facebook thing from time to time. So I'm just going to tell everybody, do not click a link in our comments field. I'll try to get rid of these guys. It's very irritating. But anyway, Barbara, they're trying.
Crime is everywhere, right?
They sure are. But I'll be monitoring the Facebook feed for comments. So please don't let that keep you from asking questions. And I think I'll stick around, Barbara.
Okay.
That sounds wonderful. You guys.
All right. So the MWA handbook, this is the most recent one, but a question I have for both of you, how recently when was the last one? How many years has it been since this handbook was updated? I knew you'd know the answer to this.
Funny you should ask. Funny you should ask, Barbara.
Okay.
This is Writing Mysteries by Sue Grafton. And there were two editions of that, one in the late 90s, one in the early aughts. The Lawrence Treat Mystery Writer's Handbook, and that was, I think, in the 80s. I forget. Anyway, this is the one that I first knew when I first was writing. And a rarity, the Mystery Writer's Handbook, which was first published in the 50s. So there have been three editions of quite a few of the articles in the first one sort of made it into the second one. As I was reading through it, I thought, that sounds very, very familiar. So they just kind of recycled a certain number of them. All of Sue's were new in her first edition. And all of the ones that we have are new. But when I first became the chair of the MWA Publications Committee 5 years ago, one of the things I really wanted to do was to have a new handbook, because I mean, we all know that writing has changed an awful lot since 2002. And we discussed among ourselves in the forum that we run for these various committees, who would make the ideal guest editor for this, because it had to be somebody who could write. You know, there's a lot of people who sell big, but you look, take a closer look at their prose and think, well, maybe that's not going to work for everyone. But you wanted somebody whose prose was absolutely spot on, but who sold well, because there's no point in having a how-to handbook that doesn't teach you how to make a living off of something. So everyone looked at each other and said, hey, what about Lee? So Lee, that's how you got pulled into it.
Well, I have two rules of thumb about this. Number one is, if Sue Grafton did it, then it's probably a good idea. And secondly, if I get a chance to work with Lori King, I'm going to, because I find, and this is so relevant to the handbook concept. Lori is, if you read her, she's a writer in love with writing, with words, with images. It is a joy to read, and no doubt a joy to do. But also in person, Lori is one of the most common sense people that I know. Zero BS with Lori. And I felt we would get a great handbook out of that, because that's what you need. You need the joy of writing. You just need to abandon yourself to that. But you also need a lot of common sense. And I felt that, you know, MWA is something everybody knows. It's just a thing. But if you look back 75 plus years, it really started out very blue collar. It was a very down and dirty organization that was virtually a trades union. It was about getting more money for what were very disregarded writers back then. I mean, now in the genre world, we have a certain amount of credibility and a certain amount of notice and attention. But back then, that was really not true at all. I mean, a lot of these people worked anonymously under multiple pen names. They were fantastically productive. The whole thing was completely different. And MWA was about supporting them in practical ways. And I felt, yeah, I'd really like to do that for the new generation, because like we said, the last one was, what is that now, 19 years ago. And an awful lot has changed in 19 years. And so we thought, let's do an up-to-date one that absolutely respects the charm and the joy of the creative process, but also is thoroughly realistic. Because if people want to get into this to make a living, it's sadly not enough to just be a great writer. You've got to do a whole lot of other things. You've got to be aware of a whole lot of other things. And so that's why we opened it up so widely. You know, MWA has got a big membership. Ideally, we wanted them all involved. And 70 writers said yes when we asked them. And it was, that is not a small deal. I mean, doing these essays is time consuming. You know, you got to think. And to get 70 writers just to say, yeah, I'll do that was fantastic. And then we also put out an appeal to everybody, just a one-liner if necessary. What is the best advice you've ever heard or ever given, or an anecdote or something illustrative of what we're talking about here? So we have that in as well. So I think it is a wonderful book, albeit a bit bogus, because the title, How to Write a Mystery, sort of sounds like, all right, I'll read this book and then I can write a mystery. But the publisher didn't want an entire essay on the front. They need a fairly sort of comprehensible title. So How to Write a Mystery is the title, but I think what the book shows is there is no one way. There are hundreds of competing ways. And what happened to me in my career was that I started out and very quickly started going to the conventions like we all do. You know, the MWA run, Edgar Week stuff, and BoucherCon and all of those things. And the way you learn is you spend 20 years eavesdropping on these other writers, and you will hear things that chime with something that you've been thinking about or contradict something you've been thinking about. And the more you attend those things, the more you eavesdrop, the more you learn. And so in a sense, this book is, it's designed to save people 20 years of conference attendance. It's all in here. All of that stuff you're going to overhear in the bar, they've written down for you. So I don't know what the, what is the price of the book? $27. For $27, it saves you going to 20 years worth of conventions. So I think that's a pretty good deal.
Not only 20 years worth of conventions, but an enormous saving on your bar bill. And that reminds me that I wanted to, because the book actually publishes tomorrow, but we've been allowed to have this discussion this evening. So a toast to the two of you and to How to Write a Mystery on the eve of publication.
And to the other 68 writers. Mm-hmm. To the other 68 writers. Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to follow the notes for this, because it started when Lee and I had tossed some ideas around, and then I went back to the publications committee, and we looked at what topics do you want to see in a how-to book? What do you really want to know? And of course, it comes out this huge list of things that we had to then narrow down and narrow down and narrow down. And the choice of people was really exciting, because we all had ideas for who we'd like to see on certain things. And we wanted to get some people who you wouldn't necessarily think of on a topic that they were absolutely right for. Most of the people in the book, certainly those that we asked, the larger essays, have not been in one of the manuals before. It was mostly we wanted a new generation. I was in the chapter on historicals, I think. But there's only a handful of us who are in both of them. Because we wanted new voices, we wanted interesting people. We wanted to hear what Lindsay Fay had to say about writing a rhythm. I mean, you think of Lindsay and you think, okay, we'll talk about, we can talk about writing historicals, we can talk about research, but what about something that is deeper? Similarly, we had some choices that you wouldn't necessarily expect to find in a writing handbook like Neil Nyron, who's an editor. But by God, who knows about how writing works if not Neil Nyron? And we wanted him to talk about the why. You know, what are the rules? Why do we use them and why do we ignore them? As Lee said, you know, all those things that you write these books and then you think about, well, maybe other people know what they're doing too.
It's a very good, his I thought was a very good introduction. There are three that I was particularly struck with. I thought Jackie Winspear did a wonderful article about historical mystery. Not so much how to write them, a whole feeling for it. Is she so careful? You know, she's a careful writer. She's a careful prose stylist, and she really digs deep into history. So I thought she was great. I thought Mae Gardner's was wonderful and really funny. I could have read a whole book. You know, if she'd gone on for 200 pages, I'd have been really happy with it. I loved what she said, but. Sometimes, you know, style, even in a how to write a book, the voice can really make a big difference. And then Mr. Deaver, I thought, made a very compelling presentation of, as he would, and as I've heard him, I mean, you know, he and I have done events together for 30 years, so I've heard Jeffrey on outlining forever. My favorite Jeffrey Deaver line he ever said to me was somebody asked him, you know, at what point he quit revising. Because, you know, he's so careful. And his reply was that they would allow him to hang by his heels on a trapeze over the press while it was running, he would still be revising. But, you know, I think he makes a great case for why plotting matters for people who can do that. But he also respects people who can't do that, which certainly includes you, Lee. I mean, we had a really good discussion about that the other night with DJ Palmer. Why you don't outline.
Deaver and I are just so on the opposite ends of the spectrum with that. And I love Jeff Deaver, absolutely love him as a person and as a writer and as a peer and a colleague. My world would definitely be poorer without Deaver, but he is so wrong about the outline. I mean, his outlines are longer than my novels. To me, I admire that, because the reason why I don't like outlining is because I like the spontaneity. I have to have the same feeling that I have as a reader. When I'm reading a great book, I'm desperate to get back to it, to find out what happens, or just to luxuriate in the next chapter or whatever. I just want to get back to it full of that excitement. And as a writer, I have to do the same thing. I have to sit down in the morning and not know what I'm going to do that day. And that makes me excited. It makes the book come out better. If I did Deaver does like a 300 page outline. If I got to the end of that, then the story is told. It's over for me. There's nothing left except typing. And how interesting could that be? And so, you know, I do apologize for the inclusion of Deaver's essay, because it is completely misguided. But
he said the last word. because you came in at right after him. So we have Jeff Deaver on why you must outline, and then Lee Child, why you should never outline.
And we wanted to put that as a sort of core thing because, you know, Jeff and I have been at loggerheads about this for years, but it also illustrates the fact that there is no single answer.
That's right.
And so it's really a smorgasbord of advice here that I'm suggesting that people, I said in my essay, don't take notes, don't make lists, don't work it out ahead of time. But actually, yeah, read the handbook, and probably 50% of it is no good to you because that's not how your brain works. But the other 50% will be really invaluable. And that mixture will be different for every intending writer. And so I think that's what's going to be fascinating about the reaction to the book is I guarantee everybody's going to say half of it is nonsense, but it'll be a different half. It'll be strands that are unique to the individual writer, which is of course inevitable because every single book is always different. One thing I would love to do, and maybe I'll press Gangloria into doing it, is to have some kind of competition where everybody gets the first same paragraph and has to write a novel based on that. And the divergence from the next page onward will be incredible. And every novel will end up with a fingerprint of its own author, even though it started at the same place. And so, you know, like I said, I feel a little apologetic if people think they're going to pick this up and next week they're going to be James Patterson. It doesn't work like that. You're going to pick it up and you're going to read through it. And some of it is going to really strike home and some of it is going to whiz over your head. And that's fine because there is no one answer. You've got to work out all the strands and the components for yourself. And I guess the real help we can give is shortcuts. Something that might take you 2 years to figure out, you might understand instantly by reading the essay. And I'm glad you mentioned Jackie Winspear, actually, because it struck me when I read her essay, she is one of the very few authors that both me and my wife fight over the new book. It's one of the very few that we both read with equal enthusiasm. And that is almost a category in itself because there is a huge gender issue too with writing that we have this peculiar circumstance where men readers are reluctant to pick up women writers and possibly vice versa as well. And if you can have a story that appeals equally to men and women, then that's a really great thing. So, but I didn't think it was worth having a separate category for that because it's very hard to define and it's very rare, I think.
Well, I will make a comment, Lee. I mean, you've known us for almost 30 years. We're basically a gender neutral bookstore. I mean, the staff is gender neutral. God knows the age range is spectacular, you know, 80 down to 20, I think. Did Talon just turn 21? Anyway, very large. But the thing is, we have over the years spent time with lots of authors that I call gender neutral. For example, Tony Hillerman. It didn't make any difference whether you were a man or woman. You read Tony Hillerman and now you read Ann Hillerman, whose new book, Stargazer, is absolutely brilliant. And one thing she does is that she brings technological language. The thing takes place at the very large array in Santa Fe, which is basically radio, telescope, and the whole bit. She manages to tell you how it all works without boring you and without it being like chunks, you know? It's amazing. But I consider her to be a truly, the Hillermans together appeal equally to men and to women. And we have found over the years, lots of authors, haven't we, Patrick, where, you know, I mean, we don't have a lot of, you know, I'm a man, so I'm never going to read Sue Grafton, or I'm a woman, so I'm never going to read.
Your clientele is so intelligent then, obviously, but I mean, it's a big problem in the mass market.
Yeah, it is. And I think a lot of genre fiction, I think Cozy, for example, is very often, you know, heavily women, the domestic suspense thing. It was interesting talking to you about DJ Palmer, who's masquerading, well, sort of, as possibly a female writer, because that genre is very heavily dominated by female readers, whereas we have a big thing about military fiction at the store, and that tends to be guys. So it was interesting. We had Ann Hillerman and Jack Carr and John Sanford back to back a week and a half ago. I mean, literally back to back, you know, bang, bang, bang. And yet, Patrick, didn't you think the audiences were relatively the same? You said maybe Jack's was more men, but loads of women really love James Reese. And I'm sure the movie is going to make a huge difference. I mean, with that cast, right?
Probably.
I don't know. I mean, I don't disagree with your theory. I think one of the most interesting things about the book, and possibly of the most value to anybody, are going to be the sections that are not about writing, but about the business of writing. There's a section about copyright and legal stuff. Louise Penny talks about building a community, of which she is clearly a genius. There's some practical advice in here, is that whatever kind of writer you are, you can still use to build a career or to build a brand. And that part, I think you guys did a really wonderful job. Laurie, did you focus on that?
Yeah, that was, I had wanted to go on to, because Lee and I are pretty much the same generation when it comes to writing. Your Killing Floor came out in
97,
and my first one was 93. So, we were still of the of the generation where your publisher didn't want you to be involved. You wrote the book and they said, okay, we'll set up a tour for you, and we don't want you to do stuff. And that, of course, is flipped entirely on its head. So how a book is sold now is not the way it was sold in the 90s. So I thought that having a handbook that explores that, what is the point of having an online community? I mean, crime doesn't pay enough is the basic motto of MWA. And one of the ways that you build your income is by building your community. You make people realize that you are there, you're part of a community, they love you, you love them back, you get support from them financially, but also, as Louise points out in her thing, there's a lot of emotional support there. I mean, Louise has gone through some tough times, and her community has made it possible for her to really pull together. So you have, Louise Penny talking about community. You have an article on self-pub, which of course wouldn't have even come in Sue Grafton's book, because self-pub was vanity press and nobody did that.
Now they call it independent publishing, Laurie.
Yeah.
It's I think independent publishing is like having a sanitary engineer, come along to collect every week. But I mean, what you call it, I think has a lot to do with how people perceive it.
It's not something that I do, but a lot of people find it extremely gratifying, and they make money off of it. Yeah. And so that we needed that chapter in there, even though this is published by a traditional publishing house. Mm-hmm. I thought that was important to have a certain amount of the peripheral stuff. I mean, you don't want to get too bogged down in it, but we also wanted to have kids stuff, because I think writing for kids is a big thing. And so both to introduce the differences between middle grade and young adult, and to look at how do you excite kids about reading when, I mean, it's easy for Chris Gravenstein, but it's great to have him tell you how to excite kids about reading.
And it's very good. Aline Cogdell, I thought, did a really interesting piece about reviewing. And Patrick and I, the week before last, what was it last week, Patrick? We did a video book chat, not an interactive event, but it's running on our homepage, with Sarah Weinman, to talk to her about, her new job at the New York Times as the mystery critic. And, that I thought that was a great discussion, didn't you, Patrick?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
The value of reviewing, because Patrick's a reviewer and I'm a reviewer, but Sarah's got like the big bullhorn. But it was great to hear from Aline, because she's a very active reviewer.
And that was one of the kinds of essays in there that I think, because I some of the essays didn't need much editing, and others I really dug down deeply into them, and I said, if you are writing for writers, you have to take a different approach. And what I wanted to hear from Olin was, you know, what should I as a writer do about reviews? I mean, all of us are so baffled about, should we pay attention to our Amazon numbers or not? Should I, if I read an essay that's bad for me, should I do? So to have Olin basically say, this is why reviews count, mm-hmm. I thought would be extremely valuable. And so she and I worked out an essay that really talked to writers about the process, the reason, and the strengths that you can get from reviewing.
I thought it was very good. And back in the day when I was a librarian, before I was a bookstore, one thing that writers might not be aware of is that libraries cannot buy books unless, I think it used to be, probably still is, it had to have 2 published reviews and a credible review source before the library budget, you know, let you buy a book. So, I mean, for the library market, reviews really were essential. And we still have Library Journal, we still have Booklist that are specifically aimed towards libraries, Publishers Weekly as well, but LJ and Booklist are specially targeting, you know, libraries. So, you know, reviews really matter in terms of supporting book buying.
Yeah, and sort of all the other things that we just talked about, the online stuff. And we had to have that in, obviously. But it was done really well, because the problem with the online stuff is next year will be subtly different than this year. And 5 years from now, it'll be completely unrecognizable. But the principles will always remain the same, that we now have this opportunity to build up the community or the army of fans. And there is a lot of support in that. You know, Louise obviously was the beneficiary of it, but she also is providing support to the readers, because mm-hmm. one of the things that you get is, you know, a number of times I've had letters from somebody saying, you know, my husband is a big fan, but he's sick with cancer. Is there any way to get him the book early? And I will always, you know, if I can, if we have an advanced copy or something, I'll always send them early, because that gets that family through their particular trauma right then. So the support in the community goes both ways, and it really is a wonderful thing. And at the moment, of course, we do it with Facebook and Twitter and all that kind of stuff. A couple of years down the road, it could be something completely different, but the principle will always remain the same: develop a relationship with the reader. And I think also what the essays point out is it's not about the book. It's like a wider version of what you do at a convention, where if you're on a panel, the worst possible thing you can do is to start explaining your book and promoting the book. Just be a nice person and they'll buy the book anyway. And that is now wiping out into the internet, where if you're just a pleasant person with your group of people receiving your newsletter or your emails or whatever, never even mention the book, they'll buy it anyway.
Good point. Oh, Laurie, you're engaged very actively in a promotion campaign for Casual Shade, which comes out, in fact, we're debuting it for you on June 5th, and it publishes the next Tuesday. And we're really excited about it. Laurie and I actually took the trip together through Transylvania and Romania. So it's going to be like a reunion, possibly with photographs. But I'm really impressed at the number of things that you are doing to promote sales for Casual Shade. You know, you've got reviews, you run contests, you know, you have giveaways. I mean, you're obviously putting an enormous amount of effort into varied ways to reach readers. Is there an essay in the book? You could have written an essay in this book, I think, about, you know, multiple channels for connecting with readers.
Yeah, I think that it's basically, I don't do all my own things. I don't do the Twitter feeds. I have 2 Twitter feeds, and surprise, I don't do either of them. And I make no bones about it. I don't I don't pretend to, because I don't, you know, that's not where my affections are. But I think that shows in social media that if you are not interested in the social media, if you're not interested in Facebook, if you're not interested in Instagram, it shows. And if you're only doing it because you think that that's the way to sell books, it just goes flat. So it's an interesting way of building a community. And I adore how, when we actually have conferences that we can go to or bookshops that we can go to, how many people come together and they already feel like they know each other because, you know, there's a Facebook group, the Beekeeper's Apprentices, and they all, you know, 1500 of them chat about bees and Sherlock Holmes and all these things. And so when VoucherCon comes, there's 30 or 40 of them get together for dinner and they all know who they are, which I find really fascinating. And it's like you were saying that this business of having technology allow us to have a conversation like this. I mean, people in Australia and Europe and the rest of it can see it in a way that just wouldn't have happened before, you know.
Well, that's really absolutely true. And I can give you a great example. He is going to be joining us again on June 7th. And the chances that James Patterson and Bill Clinton and Lee would all have come to Scottsdale on June 7th to do a live event were always zero. I mean, it's only
And would you actually want? Well, would you actually want to deal with the logistics of three men? Who...
No, but my point is that Zoom eliminates this kind of technology, eliminates, for example, the Secret Service. Because the security issue for Bill Clinton goes away. Yeah. And, you know, I it's really hard. People are always saying, you know, what's going to happen when we can do live events together? But there's a live event that was never going to happen. It was only going to happen, I think, in this particular format, at least here in Scottsdale. And I think it's, you know, your handbook may need revising sooner than you think, in the sense that, as Leah's already pointed out, we don't even know what the reality will be in a couple of years.
We can always do an addendum, can't we?
You can, yeah.
One of the things that I want to actually ask Lee about is when I first showed up at your apartment in New York, and we went through a list of what we wanted to do and who we wanted to do things, you were very keen from the beginning on having a crowdsource function of it. You wanted to have a kind of contest where everybody could send in anything. If it had been published before, no problem. If they were absolutely unpublished authors, no problem. If they were New York Times bestsellers, that was fine. And then you would have this pool of crowdsourced ideas, tips, wisdom, suggestions, experiences that, and this is Lee's part of it. So that all of the parts in the book that you find, for example, is Marilyn Stasio has the shortest piece in it. That's just right there. Her entire tip is, how not to get reviewed. Send multiple copies of your book to the reviewer's home and keep bugging her by email. So that's really good to know. I mean, that's a valuable tip.
Yeah, I remember being obsessed by that idea that I wanted. I mean, part of it was format in the sense that a book of important essays, and these are, you know, these are really well thought out, well written, important essays. I felt they needed like palate cleansers or some kind of breakup between each substantial entry. I've always loved that format ever since I was a little kid, and I would go to my grandma's and she had a Reader's Digest subscription. So piled up under her sideboard would be all these old Reader's Digests. And I loved reading them. And I loved the fact you'd read the piece and then there'd be a three-liner at the bottom of the page, either a joke or a thought for the day or whatever they called it. And I felt that was a really good rhythm for what otherwise would be an intimidating book. I didn't want it to feel like homework. You had to read one heavy thing and then the next heavy thing. I wanted to break it up a little bit. And I also believe there's a lot of wisdom in one-liners and short constructions. And I wanted everybody to feel they had a stake in it. You know, as I say, 70 people responded, which was wonderful. But I didn't want anybody to feel that they were being turned away. So the idea was just send in anything you want. It can be one line, it can be 1,000 lines, it can be an essay, it can be a paragraph, whatever it is, your best advice that you've ever heard or given, and we will try to use it. And I think if you were to only read the short pieces, you'd be a bit fed up at having paid $27, but you'd get a lot out of it, actually. There's a lot of good stuff in the short pieces. And so I was very happy with it. It worked exactly how I wanted. And, you know, that Marilyn Stasio thing, absolutely. You know, that is you need to know that. I guess one of the things that is hardest to learn is that, you know, to get your, it's a capsule review that Marilyn did and now Sarah is doing, you know, it's not all that many words, a few paragraphs.
200 is, I think, the limit, according to Sarah.
Maximum 200 words. And that is huge, you know, that is huge because you've got publicists who will get what they call a pull quote. Forever it will say on your book, fantastic, the New York Times. And that is, you know, that is something that is a huge ego boost, a huge validation for the writer, him or herself. Of course, and it has a certain amount of utility. It is something that a starting out writer would dream about, totally want. But at moments like those, you've really got to tread very carefully and tread very lightly. And to have it expressed that bluntly by Marilyn herself is perfect. That is exactly what we wanted. And that advice is some of the best advice in the book. Something of paramount importance to you, you've got to just back off and let it happen and hope for the best.
I forgot to mention that Scribner is a very high quality publisher. And this is a very, very nice book. I mean, you know, it's a beautifully done book, which I think is great. You don't want to have this wonderful book and it's just, you know, poorly produced and crappy paper and, you know, all the rest of it. But it's really a handsome book. So Patrick, do you have questions of your own or questions that you've gotten through Facebook?
Yeah, there are a lot of questions from people who are watching.
Take over.
Let's see here. Okay, Heidi says, will the practical advice be valid for people outside the US? I don't see why not, right?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. I mean, this sort of brings to mind the last big tour I did was, you know, people know I'm British, and therefore we had a big upheaval in Britain when Britain left the European Union. And so a bunch of four British authors, we went on tour to many stops in Europe just to say, you know, this is not our policy. We don't believe in this. We love our European readers and we will always value you. And the feedback from that tour, you know, on the nights as we were doing the events, storytelling is completely universal. It is probably the most basic human instinct shared by all humans everywhere to tell a story, to thrill to a story, to listen to a story. One of the most basic things in every kid's life is they want to be told a story. Everybody in the world loves stories. And so, yeah, absolutely, this applies. It's a great question because I've never even conceived of it as being a US thing. It is not. I know it's called Mystery Writers of America, but the advice in the book, what the book is about, is absolutely international. It definitely it is.
I think the only section of it that might be for US only would be the legal question section. There's certain things in there that have to do with American publishing law, but in general terms, it would apply to elsewhere. Also the sections on kids stuff. I don't know the kids fiction of other countries well enough to know if their definitions, if the expectations are the same. But I would assume that they are pretty much down there, you know, along the way.
Let me stick in a plug here at the moment for a similar book, not the same book, but it's up for several awards. And Martin Edwards, who is a wonderful writer, the winner of the Diamond Dagger Award this year from the Crime Writers Association in Britain, published a book called How Done It, which has essays from members of it's the Detection Club, isn't it, Lee? I think it's, I don't think it's the CWA. I think it's the Detection Club itself. And I mean, and there are plenty of authors no longer with us where they pulled pieces like P.D. James and Agatha Christie and H.R.F. Keating and so forth. But How Done It is a little bit similar to this. It doesn't, I think, have the same practical advice, but I think it does focus more on writing. So, you know, that would be a good companion piece to this one. If you're in an international market, you might want to pick up How Done It, H-O-W-D-U-N-I-T, just one N, by Martin Edwards is the editor.
Yeah. So, what I like about this, about your approach that you've taken with this book is it's kind of like a DSM for mystery writers and readers. And it's, do you find that people who aren't necessarily writers would have a lot to find of interest in this book? You know, that are just, you know, discerning readers who don't necessarily write. Seems like the topics really run the gamut.
I hope so, yeah. I mean, I guess it depends on your personality. I'd love to know how things work. I spend a lot of time sort of eavesdropping on internet forums for really technical stuff, you know, physics or electronics and all this kind of thing that I'm never going to understand really, but I just love to know the process of how a thing works. And if a general reader, if somebody who doesn't want to be a writer but is just interested in reading, they're going to find that a lot too. And maybe you've just increased our market there, Patrick, that I think it would be pretty interesting actually for, if somebody's a reader of the genre, has no plans to be a writer, they should probably still read it because it gives you a lot of behind the curtain stuff that is inherently fascinating, I think.
Yeah, I know that that's always a fascinated, that, you know, people are always fascinated with how we as writers did something, what is the process? How do we produce this apparently seamless piece of work that just comes out there and doesn't show any of the work behind it? And to have something like, you know, my read, I wrote the chapter on the rewrite here. And you read that and you think, oh, that's far too much work.
You're the queen of rewrites, Laurie. So, you know, it's good topic. Actually, we've been promoting it. I have particularly been promoting it as to readers, not just writers, but to readers, because we find that readers are so interested. And in almost all the Zoom events we have done over the past year, people want to know about your writing process. They always want to know it.
What's so great now is that it seems like the genre has really broadened and expanded a lot and is including a lot more voices that it didn't include before. And different, you know, the infusion of different styles, you know, different from literary fiction or science fiction or whatever, the whole genre has broadened a lot. Probably even since that volume, Laurie, what was it, 20 years ago, the Sue Grafton volume? Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are ways that you see, except, you know, besides the obvious, you know, technology and social media and those kind of changes, what are some of the big changes that you see when comparing these two books, kind of the state of the genre's health, I guess?
I think in terms of content, it is as strong as it's ever been. may be stronger, and we can certainly celebrate diversity of approach, although one of the points I make in the introduction is that it was actually always thus. You know, MWA at the beginning was not a kind of prissy organization where you had to strictly speak and be a mystery writer, you know, like Agatha Christie or something like that. It was never like that. There was a huge range of different types of writers doing different types of stuff. Basically, anybody who wanted to make a buck out of a story with some crime in it was welcome at MWA. And it's still like that now. But I think, you know, clearly we have seen writers of color. We have seen a different sort of class approach, I think. We have more different types of writers now than ever before. And that's all to the good. So I would say the genre right now is potentially stronger than it's ever been, because we have such a base of writers of such strength and variety that one assumes they're going to move forward now in all kinds of different strong directions. And so in 20 years, when we're all gone, and whoever inherits Laurie's seat on the publications committee is going to be saying, we need another edition, it will be a whole different landscape, although fundamentally the same. It'll be both the same and different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that looking at Sue's books, they are fairly fairly standard of an approach. That is, this is what a mystery is. Sorry. This is how we produce it. But one of the things we are headed for in this book is cozies and thrillers and graphic stories and all of these lovely things. You know, we have a diversity statement for MWA. And one of those things that we include under our umbrella is the diversity of style. One of the things that we as a publications committee, we as a committee of Edgar's judges look at, we don't want to be locked into one style any more than they did in the 40s when they were first starting. We want to look at the quality of the writing, whether it is something that is classified as a cozy, classified as a hardcore thriller, or a you know, however you categorize the important part of a graphic story. But all of those things are the celebration of mystery writing. And I think that's very clear in this book, and I'm really happy about that.
I think one thing that we all have to take into account is the enormous burgeoning of crime fiction written in other countries, written in languages not English, and, you know, either translated into English or whatever. But there's an enormous range of international mystery that I just wrote our newsletter for May. And, you know, I have authors in it who are German and Indonesian, and I can't remember what. And I think that crime fiction, which was really basically kind of an American and British literary form for a while, has really spread across the globe. You know, there's fabulous stuff being written in Japan, for example, and being brought, you know, into English translation. So.
And to add a wrinkle to that, Barbara, what I find really exciting is crime fiction coming out of places where there has been a recent conflict. Mm-hmm. If there's a terrible conflict somewhere, then usually one generation later, the crime fiction is magnificent. We're seeing that out of Northern Ireland right now. We're seeing it out of South Africa. In Germany, the reunification of Germany was not like a civil war or anything, but it was a significant change to the society. And now a generation later, we're seeing fantastic stuff out of Germany. So there are motivators in history that will produce these eruptions of great writing after a certain interval. And internationally, it's fabulous at the moment.
It really is. It's very exciting to, I was asked to write a chapter about Agatha Christie for an academic book. And one of the people I asked to work on the chapter with me was Ragnar Jonasson, who's an Icelandic author. And yet he was inspired to write his crime fiction by Agatha Christie. You know, so you can see her influence is enormous. And, you know, other people in other cultures are, and other countries and other cultures are developing their own fiction.
I think that makes another very good point, which is that you get your basic inspiration. I mean, an Icelandic guy looking at Agatha Christie, what does he see? He sees a closed society, you know, the locked room in its most elemental, or the manor house, or the village. And the closeness of it obviously rang a bell for Ragnar, because Iceland is a fairly small and homogenous place. And so he was kind of living in a locked room mystery. And yet he was able to extract the meaning from Agatha Christie and apply it in his own circumstances. And I think that is one of the great things about reading, is noticing what is important, what chimes in with your own circumstances. And it can look radically different. I imagine Iceland looks nothing like those little villages that Agatha Christie wrote about, but the feel is the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I think village life is, and you know, there's one of them that's almost like a country house murder, you know, and you can apply the country house murder form to a cruise ship or inside a theater. I mean, it's a remarkable structure, you know, where you have to limit the number of possible suspects there's a crime. And
Alistair, you know, MacLean used to do that on a submarine or weather station in the Arctic. They were all basically Agatha Christie closed room mysteries.
Yes, but then on the other hand, she says, as Neil points out in his wonderful essay, which I really enjoyed, you know, the idea is there should only be one villain in a traditional mystery, but then she wrote Murder on the Orient Express, you know, which everybody, all 13 of them are actual murderers, you know. So I think one of the reasons she endures as a, you know, kind of a godmother of all of this is that she wasn't afraid to break the rules. She had an unreliable narrator in Roger Ackroyd, you know, she had multiple murders in the Murder in the Orient Express, you know, I mean, she really was just a genius at coming up with different forms that all work as crime fiction or mystery, but, you know, she wasn't afraid to break rules, which I love. I thought your essays were great, and I really love Meg Gardner's essay, as I say, partly because it's just so funny and it's so well written, but she points out lots of things, and I think readers will really enjoy looking behind the curtain, as Laurie has pointed out, and seeing, you know, how we got, you know, a reader only gets to read the final book. That's the thing. The reader, the only version of your book the reader gets is the published one, and they don't get to see, you know, all the first draft and then the revisions and then, you know, the editorial comments.
The sausage is being made.
From sales and, you know, all of the process is hidden from them. You know, they only get the final. And so they think that that's the way the book was from the beginning, most of the time, you know, that it only existed like this ever.
Have you ever seen that wonderful Far Side cartoon where it shows Herman Melville kind of hunched over his desk? And there's all these crumpled pieces of paper, you know, call me Herman, call me Stanley, you know, call me, he's writing, call me Ishmael. It's great.
So more questions? Sorry, we can't. I keep running my mouth when I should be quiet. Sorry.
Actually, our friend Robin Bursell, she says, whet our appetites. What is a quick best piece of advice Lee and Laurie received early on?
Hi, Robin. Very nice to hear from you. I got one piece of sort of industry advice and one piece of writing advice that I always remember. And the industry advice, you know, when you're trying to choose if somebody is offering you a contract or something and somebody else is bidding, the advice was from Harlan Coben. And he said, go where the love is. And that's how I've always operated for contracts. I go where I feel that the people really love the project, not just that they want to make some dough out of it, but they love the project. And the other piece of advice I got that I absolutely believe in is don't get it right, get it written. Which sort of chimes in with another Harlan Coben piece of advice. He says, you can fix bad pages, you can't fix no pages.
How about you, Lori?
Yeah, I think that that's something that every new writer needs to hear, is that you're never going to write a good first draft. I mean, your first draft is just garbage. And I think that the fact that the writing industry and the writing system is based on the old Bush thing, the faith-based initiative. I mean, that's publishing, is that, you know, you just kind of step into it and you write and you have faith. And I mean, like Lee, I'm sort of astonished by somebody like Jeff Deaver, who can write his way, you know, just plot out all the Lego pieces of a outline and yet still have the passion to write a story. I think that the fact that everybody writes differently and everybody has to write their own way is something that isn't necessarily obvious to the beginning writer. Right. But I hope that it would be by the time you finish reading a good handbook such as this one. So.
To be fair to Jeff, I need to point out that he's a lawyer, and legal training does in fact kind of push you in the direction of which he pursues his books.
I just find it fascinating because there are people whose brains work that way, yeah, and who can write something and they plot it out in their mind before they put the words on the page, and yet it comes out smooth and natural and alive. I can't. I mean, if I try and do that, I'm just going to get to the end of my outline and say, okay, I've written it. That's it. I'm not, I mean, you want a book too?
Right. Patrick, any other questions?
Carl just came in with a good one. And his comment is, Agatha Christie and others illustrate that breaking the rules, as Beethoven said, requires first knowing the rules one is breaking, which is interesting insight. When you were putting this together, are there rules? That's one thing.
Well, I mean,
Chapter 1.
We should have said, or I think we should have said, yeah, of course there are rules, and of course you got to learn them, and you got to learn an awful lot of stuff. But the way you do that is by reading before you ever contemplate becoming a writer. There's no point in doing it. I don't understand the motivation for wanting to be a writer unless you've loved being a reader. And so you pick up the rules subliminally. They kind of form in your brain. It becomes part of your DNA. By the time you've read for 20 or 30 years, then the rules are there. And then you can start breaking them. It's not like you go to writing school and first learn the rules and then break them. You know the rules already because you spent your life reading. And I think that cannot be overestimated, that if you have read all your life, you stand a chance of being a writer. If you have not, there's no way it'll happen.
Well, for instance, Lee, with the Jack Reacher books, I mean, the magic so much for so many of us is the voice. How did you arrive? Did you have any false starts when you were writing Killing Floor, when coming up with that voice? No,
the voice was, again, this is something you've just got to jump off the building and you've just got to, like Laurie said, have faith that it'll work. And again, one of the mistakes people make about writing is that they think it's somehow formal. You know, they think it's a bit like giving the father of the bride speech at the wedding, where you've got to dress up, you've got to put on a suit and tie, and you've got to approach it with a certain amount of formality. And that's absolutely not true. If you can talk, if you can tell a joke, if you can have a conversation across the table in a pub, then you can write. Just write it down as it's occurring in your head and it'll be okay. Do not start thinking, oh, this is a book. I have to approach it sternly and formally. No, not at all. If you can tell a joke, you can write a novel. It really is that simple.
I think there's also a difference between rules of writing and rules of publishing. I mean, Neil Niren wrote the first chapter in there, and it has to do with the rules and when to break them. And he talks about, you know, there are certain kinds of expectations that a reader has that if you wish to be in the publishing industry, and MWA is the professional mystery writing organization, if you wish to be in publishing as a professional, you have to be aware of the rules. You may break them, and the good readers do. But you also have to know why they're there. So
let's see here. Laurie, did it take you a while? Actually, this question for both of you, which is, did it take you a long time before you found a voice that you felt was really your own when you were writing, when you're starting to write?
I mean, the question is, do I have a voice? You know, I write a number of very different things. And I would say that the voice that Mary Russell writes in, a first person, elderly, talking very formally, is very different from the books that are set in a more contemporary time. So I think that when it comes to voice, that you have to hear it in order to get it on the page. And then you have to go through in your rewrite and make sure that it is not slipping, because that's what happens, is that it tends to slide sideways.
I would say that, I mean, voice, I think, is two separate things. It is, we should remember that love of story, as I said, is a very human thing and has been probably for 100,000 years. And almost all of that time, it has been oral, literally involving a voice. And it's really only very recently, in a very sudden blip, that regular people like us have been reading off a page. You know, for 100,000 years, we were sitting on the floor listening, literally listening to a voice. And so that aspect of the voice is one thing. It's got to be warm, attractive, compelling, somehow hypnotic, somehow keeping those people sitting on the floor and not fidgeting. So that's one part of the voice. The other part is a really deep inhabitation of the character, so that it is not the author necessarily talking. It is the character's voice that you're hearing. And that involves really a tremendous feat of imagination. You got to think yourself into the character's body, essentially. I just read a pre-publication copy of T. Jefferson Parker, his new novel called 1,000 Steps, set in Laguna Beach in 1968, you know, very changing time. 16-year-old boy whose elder brother is in Vietnam, whose sister is missing. And so he's this confused, changing boy at this confused, changing time. And Jeff inhabits him so thoroughly that he constantly talks about how hungry the kid is. Because when you're 16 and you're growing, you are hungry. But of course, adult writers forget that. You lose that sense. But what he did, he inhabited the character with such force of imagination that he remembered, yeah, when you're 16 and you're growing, you're starving all the time. And it was just yet another strand that made that book really good.
I think it's important to say to readers, I do this all the time, that not every voice is going to appeal to you. And it's okay, you know, to read a selection of books and like voices that stir you or you warm to or whatever, and, you know, discard the ones that don't. Life's too short to read books that don't work for you, and not every voice is going to. It just, you know, just the way it is. I think many of us feel we have to finish a book if we start it. And I wish that more people would recognize that, you know.
Yeah, you know. I know the truth. I was about 35 before I realized if I didn't finish a book, it wasn't my fault. It was the author's fault. You know, that's a huge discovery.
I don't think think it's fault. I think it's just, you know, you meet people that bore you or you don't particularly like. And that's also true with books. You know, nobody's fault. It's just kind of a, you know, it's a bad match, so to speak. I remember, you know, I was brought up by children of the Depression, and, you know, it was like, you have to clean your plate, right? You know, there no, and it's sort of the same way for food. You know, you have to, you know, you can't start a book without finishing it because the starving Chinese will, you know, and you got to get over that. You just do. And it's very liberating, I think, when you recognize that you can start a book, and if it's not working for you, you can put it aside. So voice is such a personal thing, you know, personal to the author, personal to the reader, just the way it is. Anything else, Patrick?
I don't think so. Nothing that really jumps out. I think we've covered most of what they're talking about here. Although I should say, Lee, kind of make a note of that anthology idea you came up with a while ago, which is, you know, each story starts with the same paragraph, and see, that is a fantastic idea.
It really is, but it
ought to
be short.
Everybody else is dialing in on it here too.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it would work for a novel, but I think it would be brilliant.
There's an MWA anthology in that, Lee.
Absolutely. You bet there is.
Well, I agree. Short story would be the best way of doing it, but it would be fascinating how rapidly they would diverge.
Absolutely. And also how different the voices would all be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, not just the plot, but the way the story is told would be dramatically different. I think it's a brilliant idea. Laurie, you're the chairman of the publication committee, so please write this down.
Okay, we don't have a 2024 one yet, Lee. Yeah, we'll sign you up for it, okay?
Lee gets to write the first paragraph.
Yeah, that's about my level.
Okay.
I love it. This has been so much fun. Thank you very much, both of you, for allowing us to do this. And I love this book. And honestly, you know, in a time of pandemic when our attention is somewhat fragmented, and I said this earlier about the MWA anthology that Michael Caride edited, a book like this is a wonderful comfort because you can pick it up and you can read a bit. And then, you know, you don't have to feel guilty that you put it aside, or maybe you don't have enough time to, you know, commit to reading an entire book, but you can dip in and out of it. And I thought that the, what's the title of the Caride again, Patrick? I've lost
called,
it.
Called When a Stranger Comes to Town.
When a Stranger Comes to Town is just great. And again, it gives you an opportunity to sample voices and different plots and styles and so forth. And you haven't committed a whole lot of time to it.
It's getting fabulous reviews. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, and you know what's really great about it is the authors you don't know. We talked about that. It's not like the big names that are in that anthology that really are, I mean, they're good, but I think it's wonderful that they introduce you out of 19 authors to a whole bunch of authors you've never heard of before. Gives you a chance to listen to voices that you've never read. And, you know, who knows who these who they may develop into. But I thought Michael did a really great job with that.
Well, he always does. And I mean, that's the exact point of those anthologies. You buy it for the big names and you love it for the unknown names.
Very true. And Steve Hamilton said, and I think it's true, that generally when you get one of those, you start out reading the authors that you're familiar with that you like, and then, you know, you can progress to the ones that are unfamiliar to you. So I love it that today we got a chance to do two MWA publications, one the new anthology and then one How to Write a Mystery, and they both publish tomorrow. So anyway, thank you very much for your time. It was wonderful to see you both. I'll see you both in June, actually almost back to back, Laurie on June 5th and Lee on June 7th.
Awesome.
And meantime, enjoy the rest of your evening and thank you for joining us. Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.